the accident is two accidents. First accident, your car starts slowing down. The second accident, you strike the inside of your car. The number of times that people have not worn a seatbelt and been heavily injured or left the car and the car rolls over them. Foolish, foolish accident. So it isn't just the government saying, we're controlling your life and you're going to wear a seatbelt. They're really trying to keep you alive. They're trying to stop you from creating great big medical bills that are going to make everybody...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
They're trying to protect you from those great big medical bills, from the injuries of your accident, that are going to make everybody's insurance rates go up. And they're not just trying to control you. There's darn good motivation. And I'll bet you there are at least 10 or 15% of the population is fighting mad about the fact that the government has forced every car to have a seatbelt, and the alarm will go off if you drive the car without the seatbelt, and you'll get a ticket if you're found driving your car without a seatbelt. There's, I'll bet you at least 15% of the population is mad over that. And if they think deep enough, they'd realize they're getting angry because the government is trying to keep you alive and keep you from being maimed. And they're getting angry over that. Something not quite sane about that picture. Over to you, Mel, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. All right, well, yeah, that's right. Let me finish up the discussion, I think. You mentioned one more thing, and I think I'll just touch upon that. As I was saying before, or a few minutes back, that the units of capacitance and inductance actually are traced back to the definitions of volt, amp, and second. And as Dick said, about one farad actually, what is a farad? Just say one question this, because I won't go no further at this point, but I'll just say what a farad basically is, as Dick just brought it up. It's actually the amount of capacitance that will draw 1 amp of changing current if the voltage across it increases by the rate of 1 volt per second. So you can see that a 1 farad capacitor, that they now sell these capacitors, can, you know, store a heck of a lot of so-called energy. That's what Dick was basically alluding to. Now, I won't get into inductance, but we'll leave it at what a farad basically is, because of its size. That's why we deal mostly in microfarads in radio communications equipment. Microfarads and micro-microfarads, better known as TF. I think we'll leave it at that, Dick. Over.
I agree. I deal a lot with microfarads, and micro-microfarads are what they used to be called. They're now called picofarads. I've dealt quite a bit with nanofarads. Picofarads. Yep. Those are the most popular capacitors for radio circuits, microfarads and picofarads. Only in power supplies and things like that do we get into farads. Back to you, Mel.
N2RSO with a comment on seatbelts.
I'm going to ask is notice basically the simplicity of so far what we're dealing with. And
we'll get to your game.
Get away from supposedly missing. You'll find that as we get further into electronics, more, you know, complicated situations that we usually talk about is inductance and systems. When we start talking about what creeps into it is the factor of what we call reactance, resonance, and things like that, resonant frequency. And now the factor, of course, of 2 pi comes in, which is universal, basically. 2 pi is a universal term used all over the world. So in that case, you see, we're starting now to cross the path. But okay, I'm not going to, that we'll leave it up for tonight. I think we sort of covered this pretty well, Dick.
Yeah, without a doubt, we're going to have to revisit it, Mel, because these are not easy concepts to absorb the first time. Gabe had a question. Go ahead, Gabe.
2RSO Frank with a comment.
I'm sorry, I called you Gabe. It's Frank. Go ahead, Frank.
Hey, good evening, Dick. I just wanted to mention that for those people who are concerned about being trapped in their vehicle because of the restrictive nature of a seatbelt, they do sell seatbelt emergency cutters. I have one I keep in my Jeep, and it's basically a dual-purpose tool. It has a very sharp razor blade encased within the plastic enclosure, and you're able to slip the nylon seatbelt completely off. And on the other end is a what looks like a hammer with a sharp point on it that you can use to break open the windows if you need to escape from the car, but that's the only means you have. This tool, by the way, is available. I think I bought mine at Pep Boys, but they probably carry it at Auto Barn and other good automobile stores. Back to Ned and to RSO.
What's the approximate price of that tool, Frank?
Home Depot, any automotive store, and it's relatively cheap and it's a great tool to have.
There was somebody commenting on the price, but I believe I spent less than $10 for it. It was one of the, $7.99, $8.99, something like that.
And having a tool that can break the windows in the side of the car, at first it would sound like, gee, you'd never need that. You'd be amazed how dangerous it is to be in an automobile that is anywhere near a body of water. That is such an innocent-looking situation. You drive up to a dock, and you're watching people fish, and you think you're safe. And when your automobile is near a body of water, and you're inside the automobile, you'd be amazed how dangerous that is if the windows are up. Whenever you park at a place where you're watching people fishing, at a dock, do not take the keys out of the ignition. Unless you leave the car. You want to have the ability to turn on the ignition so you can move those windows. If for any reason you mix up the drive and the reverse and whatever, and the car goes into the water, the only way you can get out of that car, if that car goes in the water, you have to climb out an open window. You will not be able to open the door. And if you can't open the door and 10, 15, 20 seconds later the car sinks, I don't have to tell you what's going to happen. You have to swim out an open window. And if for any reason you can't open that window, you're going to be awful happy you got that hammer, you can break the glass. I wonder if you thought about that one, Frank. Go ahead.
Yes, that's exactly why I bought this tool. Unlike the front windshield, which is laminated glass, the side windows are usually tempered glass. You'll know it's tempered glass because if a sharp object such as a stone hits it, it will break into a million pieces, and they're usually dull and not able to cut you. But it does take a sharp object, usually a dull object such as a baseball, even thrown at high speed, in most cases will not break a side window of a car. But something as simple as a small, sharp rock or this tool with a point on it should be able to disintegrate the window and allow you to escape from a watery grave, so to speak. By the way, back in the 60s, I was an EMT, emergency medical technician, with a volunteer ambulance corps in Flushing, and I came across a man who had gone through a guardrail exit of the Long Island Expressway. His head did go through the windshield, and I was able to patch him up and get him to a hospital. The people at the hospital later said he got 122 stitches in the side of his face and head. That's in addition to his concussion and other injuries, but a word to the wise is sufficient. And to Arisa.
Do you believe that that guy was not wearing a seatbelt, Frank? Yeah, go ahead, Frank.
Well, I was the first one on the scene, and he was not wearing a seatbelt. Again, this was back in the 60s, I don't even believe there was a law, a seatbelt law at that time. But I wore mine religiously and still do.
Yeah, so do I. I don't feel safe without it. And when I'm the driver, I refuse to move the vehicle until all of the passengers are tied down. I don't want them becoming projectiles that hit me, if you know what I mean. There's one other thing I was going to say about windshields. Oh, approximately 5 human beings per year on Long Island die because their vehicle enters water and they were not able to open the window to swim out. About 5 people per year die. From my point of view, that's definitely 5 too many for what seems like a very simple situation if you understood the risk involved. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. All right, so I guess we sort of covered this subject pretty well. Shall we try another one?
Go for it.
Okay, I'm just reading them over. Here's one that's very interesting. All right, in fact, quite interesting. I picked up a unit at a ham pension, and it is marked a Krutt Oject filter. What is it? It's a very interesting thing. That's why I picked it out, Dick, because I remember this quite well. That ring a bell with you, Krutt Oject, C-R-U-D, Krutt Oject filter, over.
Don't think I've heard those words. Let's hope you have, Mel.
That's why I picked it out. All right, let's go back into the 70s. In the 70s, what became available was these toroidal-type coils that were used in the telephone industry. They called them loading coils, basically. They were 44 and 88 millihenry toroids that came either potted or unpotted. And they started to find their way into amateur radio, especially in for RTTY. I remember using them that for the mark and the space tones and filters. And then they started using them in making up different types of filter configurations. And QST ran a whole series of articles on what they called the Krutt-Oject. I think I've got this guy, can't remember his name, that was a very popular writer at that time. He came up with this thing called the Krutt-Oject. And it was for improving receiver. Your receivers of those days, of course, oh yeah, that guy Ed. His name was Ed, W3NQN. Ed, I remember now, called the Krutt-Oject. And it was made of these 88 and 44 millihenry toroids. Let it drop. Okay. Now, what it was is you hooked, you plugged this into your earphone jack on your receiver. You plugged your headphones into the other end of it. And the filter, there was a number of different designs of them basically, I think that like you could select different center frequencies with them and all, but they were basically based on I think 3-pole filters. I'm trying to recall offhand, but I remember them very popular. Those loading coils, those toroids of 88 and 44 millihenry ones. Over.
Now, was this filter basically a bandpass filter? Passing the most desirable portion of the audio frequency range to the headphones that constituted the major communication, or what would you call it now, intelligibility portion. So it removed the super low frequencies and removed the super high frequencies, the static, and just gave you the most desirable portion of the audio. Was that approximately what it was doing, Mel?
Actually, it was what they basically was so-called low loss. Passive bandpass filters with CW. It made the sound a little bit more pleasant to the ears. Most of them were set to frequency of around 800 hertz or 800 cycles at the time, or 1,000 cycles. And It was to improve what you had in those days. The only other way, you know, you had on maybe in like high-end receiver, like Collins mechanical filters, and that's about all you would find them in Collins. So most of the people, of course, at the time were using Nationals or Hamelin or Hollycraft as receivers. So anything, you know, you remember that things like Q multipliers and all, and these type of filters came into very active use over.
Yeah, if you're using a single sideband receiver for most code reception, the difference in frequencies of all the signals you're listening to simultaneously is they all produce a different tone. And with a Q multiplier, you can decide that one of those tones you're going to emphasize and reject all the others. And the Q multiplier works in the IF strip. Well, in the audio that comes out of the detector and goes to the headphones or the loudspeaker, again, you can emphasize a particular tone, like 800 hertz, and reject all the others. And now it makes it a lot easier to copy that Morse code. The only slight disadvantage of using a audio bandpass filter is that if you're not using a single sideband receiver, if you're using an ordinary receiver with a beat frequency oscillator, which is the way we used to listen to Morse code in the old days, then the 800 hertz could be a station that's either 800 hertz above your beat frequency oscillator or 800 hertz below. There's two possible signals that could come through. The Q multiplier would have only let through one, and the audio filter would let through two if it was a ordinary receiver with a BFO. But if it's a single sideband receiver, only one tone would come through, and the filter would be a very nice poor man's Q multiplier. I bet you've used one of those, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Oh, yeah, I've used several places. As I said, an RTTY. First of all, these toroids were very well made for those days, and if you used like an 800, remember this was a CW, which of course was very popular in those days because the requirements for CW, and they basically were called low loss passive bandpass filters for CW, and these coils usually had a Q of at least 40, so that you could have a fairly nice filter arrangement with these simple filters. Like I say, the toroids were being sold for like five for a dollar at the time, and in fact, a lot of places you really literally get them for nothing. And I guess though, as the years pass by, now I'll tell you another thing about those filters.
I just did a quick calculation, Mel.
Filters, in fact, I demonstrated that I recently was involved with people that were working with handicapped people as far as their hearing was concerned. These were hearing impaired people. And a lot of the complaints are on a number of these so-called new digital active filters is that they are a little harsh. And so I more or less showed them some better ideas, some ideas in using some of these simpler filters that are not as harsh sounding. That's what's nice. They're much more pleasing to the ear, Dick. Over.
I can see why. If you had only one pole of that filter, one LC network properly coupled to it with a Q of 40 inductor, at 800 hertz, the filter would be 20 hertz wide at the 3 dB points. But since the filter probably consists of three or four of these toroids, my guess is you had something like 5 or 10 hertz of bandwidth at 800. That would make the tone at 800 sound nice and round and smooth. And if you did a pair of these filters, one made for the Mach frequency and one for the space frequency on radio teletype, I bet you could make a very nice RTTY filter network out of those toroids. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
Roger. In fact, I'll tell you, remember now, it's coming. back to me little by little, and I'll mention why you're going to have to do a little different tweaking if you want to try it out. You'd be amazed how well they work. For simplicity, as Dick said, they're basically just a number of capacitors across coils and coupling and things like that. Basically, some of them are basically a combination of LC and bridge T circuits. Very, very straightforward. And in fact, I remember the one I had made up, if I remember correctly, with a 600 at that time cycle center frequency with a termination on it. They were all terminated, and input and output at 600 ohms, basically. With, let me see, a 3 dB bandwidth, I believe, the termination wound up at around, somewhere around 375 to 400 cycles at the time, Dick, over.
That was passband or bandwidth? The numbers you just gave us, Mel, go ahead.
Width.
I'm amazed it was that wide, but I'll take your word for it. One of the things that's not easy to understand is that when it comes to radio circuits, the most popular impedance is either 50 ohms for the United States or 70 ohms for much of Europe. When it comes to audio circuits, 600 ohms is one of the most popular impedances of things like audio amplifier inputs or headphones. When it comes to loudspeakers, you've got another set of numbers. 16 ohms, 8 ohms, 4 ohms. But audio circuit bandpass filters, I'll bet you 600 ohms is one of the most popular impedances. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
Well, remember, if we go back to those days, all the audio output jacks of your, of all the receivers of those days, those were all tube receivers, they all had a 600 ohm audio output in the front. For your earphone and a 8 ohm, you know, in the rear. Now all the modern transceivers that you will buy, the output for the earphone in the front is also 8 ohms, as is the speaker, of course. The 600 ohms, you will find that World War II surplus headphones were all 600 ohm headphones. So that's what I was getting to now. If you want to use something like this filter, let me let it drop. But if you want to use something like this filter, you're going to have to do a very simple thing. You're going to have to get a little audio output transformer that I think Radio Shack used to sell them, I know, with a secondary that had an 8 ohm winding, and the other winding on it will easily then give you enough ratio that you can put the 8 ohms to your earphone jack, put the what was the primary, the transformer, to the 600 ohm tap, and if you got old set of headphones, you can just connect it to the 600 ohm output portion of it. But if not, you need another transformer, another audio output transformer, do it the opposite, so you can get back to 8 ohms. But as Dick says, 600 ohms was a very popular for many years in the communications systems. Go ahead, Dick.
And correct me if I'm wrong on this one, Mel. When it comes to a simple crystal radio receiver, no amplification of any kind, crystal radio AM broadcast receiver, I seem to remember there the most popular, very sensitive earphones were 2,000 ohms. They had a very simple diaphragm, piece of metal diaphragm with a electromagnet inside that I think was 2,000 ohms. So I wonder if you've ever owned a set of 2,000 ohm very sensitive earphones for a crystal radio. Back to you, Mel. K2LIW.
Says K2KEY. Well, the ones that they sold, the cheaper phones at the time, you know, like you say, were around 2,000 ohms. Those were not the, you know, the World War II version of the communications headphones. Those were more of the novelty phones that were coming through, or the ones, like you said, being sold for crystal radios. They were selling, you know, the 2000. But if you, in fact, a lot of the communications phones, even the World War II, too. If you'll notice, they had a transformer in the line. I remember that now. I forgot all about it. They had a transformer in the line, which actually did convert it back to 600 ohms, because I believe that the headphones themselves basically were around 2,000 ohms, Dick, over.
How about that? Now, trying to remember those little black round transformers for audio that were popular in those days. What brand name was that? Was it Allied? No. It wasn't Belden. Can't remember the brand name of those little black round audio transformers that were about, half or 5/8 of an inch in diameter, about half or 3/4 of an inch long, with a bunch of wires coming out of the bottom. You ever see some of those, Mel?
Well, they were marketed under, known as the sub-ouncer transformers, over?
Could be, but what was the brand name on them? Many of them had the same brand name.
UTC, Dick.
Give that man a cigar. That's it, UTC. Universal Transformer Corporation, I think it was. And wonder if they still exist. You got it, Mel.
Yeah, they're still in business.
Glad to hear it. I wonder if they're still making the same product.
Still in business?
Yeah, according to, I think it was Eric or Glenn, said they're still in business. Sometimes we're not hearing you for a little while. I wonder if you're having trouble keying that transmitter, Mel.
I guess this thing here, every so often, got to push hard on this button. There's no remedy for this way, the way this thing is constructed. That's the problem. All right, yeah. I guess, like you say, UTC. I was thinking of Stancor also was a company that was around in those days, over.
Yeah, Stancor was also famous, but when it comes to these nice little round jobs, UTC, I think, was the big brand. I remember using a few of those in some of my projects. Maybe it's time to go on to the next email, Mel. And did you get a good pile of them this week?
Well, I get a lot of them. Sitting here now. Okay, hello. Okay. Yeah, I got to keep an eye on the transmit light here. Let me look. I think we got time maybe for another one, Dick.
Let's try one more.
Okay, here's one also that I've had a number of these questions. How do you test an phallum? I think my phallum is no good, or a number of people said they picked up phallums at ham fests or ones that people cut down from antenna systems and they were given. How can I test the phallum? You got any ideas?
Not easy, Mel. And by the way, quite often I think you're pronouncing it B-A-L-U-M. Baker, Alpha, Lima, Uniform, Mike is the way I think you're pronouncing it. And it really is a contraction of balanced to unbalanced. So therefore it should be pronounced Baker, Alpha, Lima, Uniform, November. A lot of people pronounce it with Mike on the end, and I think it should be November. And I recently ran through quite a test of a number of commercially made balans. I needed a balan transformer, 1-to-1 impedance ratio, which is what most of the ham radio ones are, but I needed one that operated at 900 megacycles. And up there, the iron starts becoming pretty lossy, and the balaning action becomes difficult to quantify because you have to specify a particular testing procedure and a particular physical layout. Okay, to make a long story short, I may have told you guys this one already. Let me drop. We got 6 different samples from mini circuits, and the 1-to-1 transformer, TCF1-11 or something like that, keep remembering, forgetting the model number, but they make a beautiful 1-to-1 balancing transformer where it's 50 ohms in and 50 ohms out differentially. In other words, it acts like you put a 50 ohm coax going into it, and it acts like 50 ohm twin lead coming out of it. That's the good news. And in my case, I needed to know the amount of common mode rejection on the output side. So I had to build up a test fixture to measure that common mode rejection. And so I created a 50 ohm floating resistor out of a small surface mount resistor, put that as the load on the output, measured the input impedance on a network analyzer. Everything was hunky-dory. Had 4/10 of a dB insertion loss, just like it's supposed to have. And with a carefully controlled network that I built on a small printed circuit board, modified a printed circuit board, I measured that the common mode output impedance was approximately 1,500 ohms. So in other words, if it was perfect as a balance, the common mode output impedance would be infinity, even though the differential mode was 50 ohms. And I measured 1,500, which is close enough. The thing that amazed me is that the data sheets on all of these transformers for various brand names did not tell you the amount of common mode impedance. The only reason a person would use a one-to-one balance is because he wants common mode isolation. And yet all the brand names don't tell you what the isolation is. Now, in the case of a ham radio balance, let me drop. The device is so simple. It's almost like testing a brick to find out if it's got gravity. I mean, every brick you drop, gravity's going to pull it to the ground. You don't have to test that. In the case of a ham radio balun, most of them consist of a piece of coax cable that goes down the center of that white tube, and around that are a number of these ferrite toroids spaced around the outside of the coax, with the coax going down the center of it. So if the toroids are there and they haven't been cracked into powder because the thing was flown down from the World Trade Center and it hit the ground, I mean, other than being a whole bunch of powder inside where the toroids are supposed to be, it's hard to stop it from working. And you can do a simple ohmmeter test between input connector and the output leads. The center conductor should go to one of the output leads and the shield should go to the other. So if it passes the ohmmeter test and doesn't have a short circuit, and if it doesn't have a bunch of powder inside, the Unideller and the 2AD or whatever it is, a type balance, very hard to destroy one of those. I guess it's possible if you put multiple kilowatts through one at the lowest possible frequency and overheat it, you could, in theory, electronically damage some kinds of ferrite. But even that's a long shot. So I think it's one of these situations where you almost don't worry about it. And if you want to be double darn sure, belt and suspenders, you make a poor man's balun out of a couple of turns of coax held together with black tape, and then feed that into the real balun. Even if the real balun was bad, but it passes the ohmmeter test, and you got this auxiliary coiled coax cable after it, the whole thing would have to fly. There's just no way it can't, in my opinion. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Will you ask Glenn?
Okay, go ahead, Paul.
I cracked one of those. Airline crack wound up with water in it through the SWRO out of whack. Intermittently, it says, you know, the water would dry up. It's unbelievable.
Okay, so there was a definite leak in the case. In other words, there was an opening in the case that because of age or ultraviolet, it had a crack that let water in, and then the freezing water would do terrible things. Is that what you're saying, Paul? And if so, I think it's an unusual case. How do you think you got the opening there in the first place?
Yeah, that was an error in removing one of my antennas. I had it on a homebrew two-element 10-meter beam. When I took it down, you know, it was a little rough in the coming down part, and it, you know, it hit it. But, you know, I didn't think anything happened, you know. Then when I used it on a dipole, you know, I later on put it on a dipole, I wound up with this water condition. Taking it down, I started opening it up, and there was water in it, and then as I, you know, forced it with paraplies, I could see that there was a hairline crack in the side of it.
Do you believe that that particular failure of your balun, which is a bit unusual, could have been discovered by a real serious visual inspection? Go ahead.
No, you couldn't see it. Even when I had it in my hand, until I put pressure on it with a pair of channel locks, and then I could start to see the crack open up. It was hairline, but it enough to get water in there. It's unbelievable. But, you know, very unusual. Very hard to destroy these things. But I did it.
was the hairline crack in the vicinity of your two output rings that go to the dipole? Go ahead.
No, it was in the body where the top cap meets the what is it, inch and a, I think it's an inch and a quarter, inch and a half PVC. And the inch and a half PVC itself, not the cap. Unbelievable.
So the body, the cylindrical body of the PVC had the crack, not the cap and not the rings coming out. So the body itself had the crack. Unusual.
Very unusual. Yeah, I gave it a good shot, you know, when this thing came down. But, you know, I didn't think anything happened to it, you know. The rotator was good. Everything was good, you know. But sure enough, later on, I mean, it's possible. It was in a factory, and, it could have been, like, there already. And all I did was, you know, put it to its end by doing that. I mean, it's possible, but highly unlikely. I mean, it looks like a hard thing to destroy, but I did it.
When you were disconnecting that antenna, did that balun get thrown down onto the concrete?
Yeah, onto the grass. You know, I was bringing the whole antenna system down in one shot with a pipe. And pipe, I've got like a pipe tower. And, you know, I just lost control the last couple of feet, you know. I wanted a body to hit a tripod stand, which it did. But, you know, it just missed. And it caught the end, as it was coming down. It hit the antenna with the shock through the antenna into the balun. The balun was sent located on this thing. That's enough to do it. It's quite a bit of force, but it has to hit just right.
Okay, good unusual case. You got it, Mel.
This is K2KEY. Yeah, one of the reasons that balance, I should say, as Dick said, balance for unbalanced, so it should be pronounced balon and with an N. And they said that one of the problems is water getting in, destroying the inside, actually eating up a good part of the inside sometimes. But basically, balun is there to provide you with a situation that provides two equal and opposite voltages to a balanced load, such as taking it, putting up there at your dipole, and connecting it to an unbalanced transmission line, known as the coaxial cable. Now, to test it, usually, as Dick says, simple measurement with a DC resistance measurement, usually between the unbalanced input terminals and the ground with balanced terminals and open circuited situation. If it has a tertiary winding, now some of the other ones there, yeah, came through, had a tertiary winding, and with that one, you're actually going to measure a short circuit across if you test the, across the balun, you'll get a short circuit because of the tertiary winding. So the only way you can really, if you want to start making some real accurate ohmmeter tests and things like that, years ago what they were doing in the early days, they actually would say to you, they used a Wheatstone bridge measurement process. Let me let it drop. Testing the winding, it's not as simple, basically, as just making, in some cases, a test with just a ohmmeter. You've got to get in a little bit more if you want to, make some more accurate tests. And, you can measure, start measuring inductance and things like that. I'm trying to think of some other ways of measuring, Dick, over.
Yeah, do you think it's got a tertiary winding or another RF choke or something like that in there, which would goof up the ohmmeter test and make it look like it's shorted? And the next test I would consider doing would be putting a 70 ohm resistor or a 50 ohm resistor, but let's call it a 70 ohm resistor, across the two output terminals of the balun, make it a 1-watt resistor, find a good sensitive standing wave ratio bridge, cut back your transmitter to the 1-watt level or lower, feed 1 watt into the balun, and measure the standing wave ratio. That would measure the throughput characteristics, and you could do it with and without the 70 ohm resistor there. With the 70 ohm resistor, you should measure a very low standing wave ratio. Then remove one lead of the 70 ohm resistor. You should measure a very high standing wave ratio. That's one way of doing it. And then to really measure the baluning action, you could do it by leading the 70 ohm resistor across the two terminals, connect an additional shorted wire between one of the output terminals and the ground of the input terminal. And if the balun is a real good one at your frequency, there should be only a minor change of the input standing wave ratio when you do that. And double check it by putting the short from the grounded input to first output number one and then output number two while the 70 ohm resistor is there. Now you're really measuring isolation characteristics. In the case of an ideal balun, you should be able to feed, let me drop, a very unbalanced dipole, like for instance a Wyndham antenna, which I think is fed something like 13% from one end, and still get a good standing wave ratio. The so-called common mode rejection ratio is what we're testing with the short circuit test. I've never read a procedure anywhere that performs that test, but I think you see where I'm going here, Mel. And we've got about 2 minutes left. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Gotcha. Yeah, I remember that they did outline some simple tests that for testing balun type of devices once one of the magazines. And it involved, some impedance measurements and all that kind of stuff. And so I guess the simplest thing is to not to really worry about it. If you get a new one, I'm sure it will be pretty good shape. And usually if you just hook it up and everything and put it through an antenna and everything is within reason, the antenna's cut properly and it's within reason, you see a reasonable SWR, you can almost assume that that transformer is working quite right. That's the best thing to do, Dick, because I've gotten to think of ways of, you know, testing it, but I think it'd be a little bit more difficult than, just making simple resistance, or using, when you get involved with using like a vector voltmeter and instruments like that. So I think I could say it's simple just to do it simply, put it up there, over.
I agree with you, Mel. Okay, we're reaching the bewitching hour, 73 you all. You've just spent another 4 hours of your life listening to TechNet number 1215 of the series that began back in 1982. This is year number 26 as of last September. Craziness. Bye-bye you all. Be kind to each other. And Mel's going to say his final words. See you guys next week. K2RAW clear. Over to you, Mel.
Thanks again for everybody joining us. And 73, take care. Have a good week. Don't forget to fix that where you think, though. It does save lives. And we'll try to get through as many emails and all. Keep them coming. And thank you very much for a lot of complimentary ones that we get. I must mention that. And again, try to keep it in the realm of questions that we can answer on the air, and simple questions more or less. I keep getting these very complicated problems that people are involved with, and I know it's not amateur radio. We cannot help you. Again, I have to really emphasize that every so often. 73 is good night. This is K2KEY.
The time is 12 a.m.
8:30. Welcome to the WQEL repeater. The time is 1:23 a.m. 73. And good night from the WQEL repeater.